and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the chief financial officer of Huawei, the Chinese telecommunications equipment and consumer tech giant, was arrested in Canada at U.S. request. The Trump administration wants her to be extradited to face trial on charges of violating sanctions on Iran, but Huawei's business in Iran is perfectly legal under international law and under the terms of the JCPOA, which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from. Next, the funeral of former President George H.W. Bush was held yesterday in Washington, and his body was return to Texas, where he will be interred today. Every day this week, we're talking about the Bush legacy. Today, we discuss Bush's response to the AIDS crisis. Then, it's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And then, global carbon emissions rose by 2.7% this year, following a 1.6% increase last year. Scientists blame strong economies in India and China and say that those countries are burning more coal and the middle classes there are buying more and more cars, but per capita carbon emissions remain highest by far in Europe and the United States. They also say that we have passed a point of no return on carbon emissions and climate change. And finally, two independent academics at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies will soon release a report in which they conclude that North Korea is expanding two missile bases that could be used to house long-range ballistic missiles. South Korean military officials said that they are monitoring the situation in cooperation with the United States. There have been no formal announcements by any party. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to U.S.-Chinese relations. The chief financial officer, CFO, of Huawei, the Chinese telecommunications equipment and consumer tech giant, was arrested in Canada at U.S. request, apparently on December 1st. The Trump administration wants her to be extradited to the United States to face trial on charges of violating sanctions on Iran. But Huawei's business in Iran is perfectly legal under international law and under the terms of the JCPOA, which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Jack, welcome back.
My pleasure to be here.
Boy, where do we even start with this? It seems to me, I'm not a China expert or anything, but this seems to me to be a direct provocation of the Chinese. Apparently, this woman was arrested on December the 1st, which Brian tells me is the day that the president was meeting with Xi Jinping. And the news of her arrest was just made public yesterday. So she's been held for, 5 days now? She hasn't violated any international law. There's a unilateral U.S. law saying that it's illegal to do business with Iran, but she's not an American. She doesn't head an American company.
She flew from China to Vancouver. She was in the airport about to change planes. She's the chief financial officer of this major Chinese company, Huawei technology company. And yeah, they busted her. And then Donald Trump came out and said, we had a great meeting with Xi Jinping. It was wonderful. And all the news for about 24 hours was there's not going to be a trade war. And Monday, the stock market soared. This morning, when the stock market opened, it went down 500 points immediately after having lost almost 800 points on Tuesday. Go ahead, Jack Rasmus.
Well, to unravel this somewhat convoluted event here, let me explain that you have to understand this from the perspective of the hardliners, the anti-China hardliners that have been in control, the faction in control of the U.S. trade negotiations. This is the Lighthizers, Robert Lighthizer, Navarro, and John Bolton. Their number one objective here is to stop China from developing next-gen technologies, meaning 5G wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence. Now, Huawei is the biggest telecom company in Asia, has major positions in Europe as well, and has been trying to purchase and penetrate the America's markets. Well, the next gen fight is over 5G wireless, cybersecurity, and AI. And this is a big company, Huawei, in China, tied in with the Communist Party and government over there. And what you've got here is an attempt, this is part of the attempt of the hardline faction to raise to the forefront the demands. of the U.S. that China back off of its China 2025 campaign to be the leader in next-gen technologies by 2030. These next-gen technologies, by the way, have significant military implications. Whoever dominates these will dominate militarily by 2030. So the Pentagon military-industrial complex Lighthizer faction wants China as part of a trade deal to back off of that. Now, there are two other factions in the U.S. negotiations, and that is the big bankers and multinational corporations who simply want more access to China's markets. Well, China has granted that to them already over the summer. A third faction is buy more U.S. agricultural goods and trade goods. China has committed already over the summer to buy $100 billion more. So the two factions in the U.S. have been satisfied, but this military-industrial complex faction, led by anti-China hardliners over technology issue, is holding up an agreement. In the G20 meeting, what came out of that was Trump puffed up the fact that China had agreed to buy more goods and China had agreed to more access. Well, China already offered that. But what Trump did was back off of U.S. positions. So he made concessions at the G20 to not impose $267 billion more tariffs and not to implement the increase on $200 billion more existing tariffs to from 10 to 25%. So Trump backed off. Well, this has pissed off, I think, the hardliners. And the hardliners are now making a move here. I don't even know if Trump knew about this, possibly, but they're making a move to throw a wrench in the negotiations, you see. They don't want an agreement without a tech agreement here. By the way, this recent deal with the USMCA, U.S.-Mexico Free Trade Agreement, has a provision in it that requires Canada and Mexico not to strike deals with any foreign country that would have an impact on U.S. trade. In other words, it's a violation of Canadian sovereignty. But that's an important thing that the U.S. got out of this. So the U.S. has asked Canada, and Canada is now complying as part of the agreement, to extradite this person. Canada is not arresting this person. They're just extraditing them to the U.S. Well, I see this whole thing as the hardliner faction of the U.S. trade, anti-Chinese hardliner faction fight over technology. And we'll see where this goes. But we've already had indications of this with the U.S. interfering with Broadcom, another China-related company, and ZTE and so forth. So you're going to see more of these company-by-company fights going on, pushed by the Pentagon industrial complex and their allies in the administration and in Congress as well.
That's the voice of Jack Rasmus. We're talking about the arrest of this chief financial officer of Huawei, the very, very large Chinese technology corporation. She was arrested on December 1st, the same day that President Trump was meeting with Xi Jinping in Argentina at the G20. After which Donald Trump proclaimed a new era of great Chinese-American cooperation. That lasted a few seconds. But, you know, I'm looking, John, there was another story, and it came out yesterday, actually. Here it is. Huawei's dream of becoming a global leader in 5G mobile networks has suffered another blow. UK telecoms group BT confirmed on Wednesday that it would not buy equipment from the Chinese tech company for the core of its next-generation wireless network. The company said it was also removing existing Huawei technology from the heart of its 4G network within 2 years. A spokesperson for BT said the decision was taken to align its mobile phone businesses, which it acquired in 2016. Now, that means, according to CNN's business section writers, that this is a huge setback,
huge,
for the Chinese telecommunications company in its efforts to be a pioneer or a leader in 5G. It seems like 5G technology. It seems, Jack Rasmus, as if we're experiencing maybe one faction in the Trump administration leading the charge, but it has the cooperation of Canada. It has the cooperation, apparently, of the government of the UK or the corporate structures in the UK. It looks like, to me, a coordinated, united front.
Well, yes, it absolutely is. And you can see it not just in Canada and the UK, but you'll probably see it in other countries emerging in Europe as well, because Huawei has a major thrust into Europe. You see, 5G wireless is the key technology for cybersecurity in the future. Whoever dominates 5G dominates the 5G network and therefore has a pipeline, a big pipeline into, looking into cybersecurity violations and so forth. So 5G and cybersecurity are linked. And Huawei is the number one leading China company. And the U.S. hardliners are cooperating with deep state or whatever hardliners in Canada, in the U.K. and elsewhere to stop these Chinese companies from acquiring this next generation technology. What this means is that the trade war is really the point of with China is the point of the spear, probably of a new Cold War over technology with China.
A Cold War means not a hot war, meaning armies are not shooting each other, planes are not dropping bombs on each other's countries. In the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, there was, of course, some hot wars. There was the Korean War, millions died, Vietnam, millions died, many other countries were intervened in. How does this end? How does this Cold War, the new Cold War, end in terms of U.S.-China relations? China's not going to stop trying to develop out of poverty and underdevelopment and become a developed country. That's going to continue. What's the U.S. real objective? What can the U.S. actually achieve here?
Well, you got to say which faction in the U.S.
Let's talk about the faction that's leading the charge, including the arrest of the CFO, the chief financial officer of that Chinese company.
That faction on the Trump team is Robert Lighthizer, who's in charge, anti-China hardliner, in charge of the negotiations now. Peter Navarro, assistant on technology to Trump, and John Bolton, you know, a notorious neocon, and they have big friends in Congress and, of course, in the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex industries. What they want is to slow down or somehow come to some agreement with China, which they won't because China won't agree, to abandon China's 2025 initiative, which is a published initiative of how they want to dominate by 2030 these technologies.
Unfortunately, Jack Rasmus, we're completely out of time. Jack Rasmus, I hope you'd be available to come back because as the stock market continues to, well, it's right now dropping as we speak. Who knows? It'll go up at some point, but a lot of volatility. The trade war between the U.S. and China and what might be considered a political cold war and perhaps a military cold war also intensifying. I hope you'll consider coming back to continue this story because obviously it's dominating global news right now. We're out of time though, John.
We're out of time. We were very happy to be joined by Dr. Jack Rasmus, who joined us from California. He is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short message.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The funeral of former President George H.W. Bush was held yesterday in Washington, and his body was returned to Texas, where he'll be interred today. Every day this week, we're talking about the Bush legacy, and today we'll discuss Bush's response to the AIDS crisis. We're joined from New York by Mark Harrington. He's an HIV/AIDS researcher, activist, and the co-founder and policy director of the Treatment Action Group. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark, George W. Bush has a long history with HIV and AIDS in that he essentially turned his back on it when he was president. He could have funded research robustly. He chose not to do that. You've been involved in this a long time. You've been an activist for a long time. Tell us about those Bush years and HIV/AIDS research.
Well, I would say that Bush was a terrible leader on AIDS. There had been some hope when he replaced President Reagan that he would be more proactive. He failed those hopes completely. We had an opportunity to accelerate spending on research and development. That didn't occur at all, or only occurred in the face of his opposition when Congress, then run by Democrats, forced his hand. And so we had a wasted four-year term where we made virtually no progress against the HIV epidemic, either in research or in policy, where we actually went backwards with retrograde ban on immigrants with HIV and travelers with HIV from entering the country, and a racist ban on people from Haiti entering the country as well.
It's hard for people who weren't there to know how bad it was, how bad the epidemic was in the United States, and also how bad the political leadership is. And so when we think about George H.W. Bush's legacy this week, frankly, you know, this isn't being talked about in the corporate-owned mainstream media, about the fact that here you had an epidemic of young people in the United States, but globally, but especially in the United States, young people dying in large numbers, and the president of the United States actually demonizing the people who were sick, actually demonizing the people who were dying, actually blaming people who were sick for their own disease. I want to play a short clip. It's before the 1992 debate when Ross Perot was running along with Bill Clinton against George H.W. Bush. Bush lost. Let's listen to a short clip and then come back to Mark and get your reaction.
Part of AIDS, it's one of the few diseases where behavior matters. And I once called on somebody, well, change your behavior. If the behavior you're using prone to cause AIDS, change the behavior. Next thing I know, one of these ACT UP groups is out saying Bush ought to change his behavior. You can't talk about it rationally. The extremes are hurting the AIDS cause.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, it's embarrassing for him to talk about ACT UP as extreme when we were politely demonstrating in his town of Kennebunkport, Maine, where the residents all welcomed us. And there's actually a video of the march. It's on YouTube. It was a very beautiful ACT UP demonstration, and it was a very evocative one, too, because for a lot of ACT UP members, it might have been their last march. As Bush's term was taken up in the years of the accelerating pandemic, over 100,000 Americans died of AIDS during his four short years in office. And it's just haunting to think about how things could have turned out differently if he'd showed leadership on day one by putting new money into research and treatment programs, housing, needle exchange. He could have saved millions of lives and decided not to.
You know, I've been following a couple of AIDS activists on Twitter just since George H.W. Bush passed away, because I was interested in their recollections of those Bush years as well. And they've been so interesting. There's one here who said that Bush just simply did nothing at all for people with HIV and AIDS. But then another one said that he deserves credit for signing the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 and the Ryan White Care Act, but overall, his 4 years as president should be looked at as one of uninterested indifference when it came to people with HIV and AIDS, that there were deaths in years ahead that could have been prevented had George H.W. Bush done something, anything relative to research into HIV and AIDS, and he did not.
And Mark Harrington, his comments show that he's actually blaming, he said, change your behavior.
Yeah, he blames the
change
victims.
Your behavior. If you said that to people with different cancers, oh, why did you work at that factory where you inhaled all of those pollutants? Or why did you drink unsafe water? George H.W. Bush actually knew nothing about the science of HIV, but he knew enough about the bigotry directed against the gay community that he was engaging in it, but he did it in sort of soft tones. But nonetheless, it's nothing other than just straight out homophobic bigotry. Go ahead.
But remember, the man had run to office on a racist campaign based on the Willie Horton ad. And so even though he usually liked to get other people to do his dirty work for him, he was not at all against being bigoted for if he felt it played to his political interests. And he certainly didn't feel that the death of hundreds of thousands of Americans from AIDS was going to interrupt him in any way in his pursuit of power. I mean, the fact that he signed Ryan White and the ADA only shows the power that the Democratic-run Congress had at that time to pass a bipartisan bill that had a lot of mainstream support that that he could sign. It's certainly no sign of either leadership or virtue that he actually did sign them.
Let's talk about how the grassroots made the difference here in terms of how the government and the politicians talked about the AIDS crisis, the epidemic that killed more than 100,000 Americans during that time period. Let's go back and talk about the takeover of the Food and Drug Administration headquarters in Rockville, Maryland. That took place in October 1988, right before George H.W. Bush became president. Talk about why that takeover happened. ACT UP organized it. It was big. A lot of people were there. They took over the building. And what its impact and the impact of other grassroots militant civil disobedience actions like that, how that impacted U.S. policy?
Well, the ACT UP was formed in 87, was reaching its height in 88, and did some of its most important actions in 88 at the Food and Drug Administration, and in 90 under the Bush administration at the National Institutes of Health. And those, along with many other demonstrations, you know, had a twofold aim. One of them was a specific institutional aim to reduce red tape at the FDA that was slowing down drug development and approvals, and to open up research done at the NIH to include the concerns of people living with AIDS, of activists, of people with color, women, IV drug users, and children. The long-term effect of those was quite revolutionary because they helped to change the way medical research is done in the United States. But I think the shorter-term effects were political and were about getting the American people, the public, the general, so-called general public, to actually pay attention to the AIDS epidemic and have some sympathy for the people who were suffering with AIDS. Because when they saw ACT UP, they didn't see AIDS victims, they saw people that were citizens that were trying to make a better place for themselves and for their country, and trying to turn around their country's neutral response to the epidemic. And in many ways, you could say that ACT UP succeeded beyond our wildest dreams, because we did succeed in getting more money for AIDS research. And within 6 years of that NIH demonstration, we had an over $1 billion AIDS research investment at the NIH, and we suddenly had effective combination triple therapy in the year that Bill Clinton was reelected, or that George Bush would have ended his second term if he had still been in office. But because those increases in research didn't happen until 93, it's just haunting to think about how many more lives could have been saved if we had started that ramped up investment effort and aggressive leadership 4 years earlier.
Mark Harrington is our guest. Yes, you are right. Many, many more lives would have been saved, because clearly at the time, say, of the takeover of the FDA in October 88, 30 years ago, hard to believe that it was 30 years ago, at that time there was no, quote, cure in sight or treatment protocol in sight, or it didn't seem to be. The despair, the urgency of the moment was so great. What about now? How has the medicine, how has the treatment protocol, how has the HIV epidemic or AIDS epidemic shifted and changed? What are the big challenges of today, both in the United States and globally?
Well, it cannot be denied that the son of the former president, George W. Bush, learned something about his father's inaction on AIDS, because he became a historic president, and probably one of the things that he'll be remembered for doing that was actually good was the establishment of the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, or PEPFAR, which is treating millions of people around the world with those highly effective new drugs that were discovered around the mid-90s. And so today, more than half the people living with HIV around the world are receiving highly effective treatment. It's been discovered that treatment can also be used as prevention, or so-called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. You know, AIDS rates went way down in the U.S. with the launch of triple therapy in the mid-90s, and death rates went down, but new infection rates were unaltered. If you look at all the years since the Bush epidemic until very recently, nationally, the same number of people was getting infected every year. And so we're not doing as well as we should be doing. We should be doing a lot better, and part of the problem is due to our healthcare system. But there are some parts of the country, like New York, San Francisco, or Washington, D.C., where a more modern use of treatment and prevention together is showing real signs of reducing new infections to levels that would be under those of an epidemic. And, you know, if everybody had access to healthcare and to those interventions, we could bring the epidemic under control, although still research is still needed so that we can discover a cure and a vaccine. So we're about halfway there. We have over 40 drugs to treat HIV, but none to cure it. We have no vaccine. When Bush entered office, there was one drug to treat HIV infection. When he left, there were three. So again, lack of leadership, sluggishness, lack of interest would characterize his approach to the pandemic.
That was the voice of Mark Harrington, who joined us from New York. He is an HIV/AIDS researcher, activist, and the co-founder and policy director of the Treatment Action Group. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. It's time again for our regular weekly segment called Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. We're joined from California by Jerry Condon. Jerry is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who's been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as national president of Veterans for Peace. And we're joined from Missouri by Michael McPherson. He is the executive director of the Veterans for Peace and a Gulf War veteran. Jerry, Michael, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, the entire week we've been doing a segment or two each day about the legacy of George H.W. Bush. Of course, it's a pretty sanitized legacy when you watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News or any of the corporate-owned mainstream media. So we want to talk especially today about the legacy of George H.W. Bush in terms of foreign policy and specifically the first Gulf War in 1991, the impact that had on the people of Iraq, the people of the region, but also on those who fought in the U.S. Armed Forces or were deployed as part of the U.S. Armed Forces to the war in Iraq. Michael McPherson, you're a Gulf War veteran. Talk about it.
I guess there's different ways to see it as a soldier on the ground at the time. I was an officer in the 24th Mechanized Infantry Division, and so we were part of something called the Rapid Deployment Force, the 82nd Airborne, 101st, and us. And so we were sent there very quickly after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So I was there for 7 months. You know, it really didn't last that long. As a soldier, being in that situation, number one, I was talking to people in my unit about why we were there, about the oil and things of that nature, and how this narrative of whether or not, you know, Bush had to make a decision, whether or not we should, as a nation, I say we, intervene, and whether or not we would go to war, and how clearly we would, because we had intervened many times before to make sure that oil kept coming out of the region. And so it was no surprise to me. So that was kind of a difficult thing because, you know, people don't like to talk about those things. But the part that, you know, looking back on, and I have mixed feelings about, is me being there, and I was afraid that a lot of us were going to die. So the question for me was not, and I remember saying this to people, it's not whether or not the United States will be victorious in terms of winning, and though no one really wins a war, foreign policy-wise, but how many of us were going to die. And one of the things that Bush and Colin Powell and everybody did was build a coalition and make sure we had a whole lot of troops there so that we really pretty much destroyed Saddam Hussein's forces, the Iraqi forces, and crippled the nation. So for a soldier who's there at the time, that's something you're not thinking about the people that you're participating in killing. You're thinking about making it home. So I have to say most of us were happy that we had the kind of forces we had there on the ground and the coalition that had been built so that we could get back home. But then when you look at, well, what were the outcomes of this and what was the impact that it had on the Iraqi people? And also the lies that were told as to why we were actually there, which I was trying to deconstruct. Not because I was just being political. It's just how I've always been. I just talk about these things. You can see that the narratives were false and that we participated in killing many innocent people. And in fact, setting Saddam Hussein up for us to forward, when I say us, the United States, to forward a foreign policy that most of the population doesn't even really truly understand, you know, what the outcomes that they were looking for and what they achieved.
That's the voice of Michael McPherson, Executive Director of Veterans for Peace, a Gulf War veteran. We're talking about the legacy of George H.W. Bush in terms of the Gulf War and how it impacted, especially American veterans, military personnel, not to mention the Iraqi people. Jerry Condon, you were a peace activist at that time. You were an organizer, as was I. I was organizing large-scale demonstrations in the run-up to the war in 1990, 1991. I also went with Muhammad Ali in November, December to Iraq, trying to make the point that it was possible to talk to Iraq. There didn't need to be a war. But actually, the U.S. wanted that war. There could have easily been a negotiated solution. And then when you think about the way the war was conducted, the merciless bombing of Baghdad, far, far, far away from the Iraq-Kuwait border, the destruction of the infrastructure, And then the economic sanctions that accentuated or made it impossible really for Iraq to rebuild afterwards. It seemed as if the United States had made a decision, let's destroy or so weaken Iraq that it would allow for a new constellation of political power in the Middle East. Anyway, what was your, when you think back about it, what's your take now?
Well, I agree with you. It seems like it was a real setup, and we see what's followed since. And so, I know Michael sometimes talks about, well, this is not like Gulf War One, Gulf War Two, and then the war against Iraq. It's all kind of one long war, and that was kind of the opening blows to it. I guess you could go back further than that, but you know, it was very contrived. And we've learned since that even the U.S. ambassador to Iraq at the time kind of gave Saddam Hussein a wink and a nod and said, you know, we don't really care about your conflict with Kuwait. So, you know, implying that the U.S. would be fine if Saddam decided to take action against Kuwait. And so it was a setup. It was a setup. And, you know, I think the hundreds of thousands of people that were in the streets at the time expressing their concern for peace in the Middle East and the world were ignored, and the beat goes on. I think the all the praise that's being heaped on the tear-jerking praise for the Bush family, the Bush dynasty, and George Bush in particular is pretty hard to swallow for a lot of veterans right now who know that they were lied to, that they were used and abused, and you know, then many of them came back with the so-called Gulf War syndrome, having been exposed to lots of chemicals and depleted uranium, and continue to suffer from that and pass it on genetic defects and abnormalities to their children. It's pretty disgusting. And then we also saw that George Bush's role in the invasion of Panama and in pardoning the Iran-Contra criminals, kind of setting the stage for a lot of what's gone on in both the Middle East and Central America, leading to this tragic crisis right now with all the asylum seekers seeking to get into the United States.
Michael McPherson, let's talk about the Gulf War syndrome. For a long time, the Pentagon said that those soldiers or Marines or sailors who were coming back and reporting that they were having debilitating illnesses, that their children were being born with defects, that it was all basically a figment of their imagination. The Gulf War, I believe, the first Iraq War, was the first time the United States used this new technology called depleted uranium. Later, many, many, many of those affected and afflicted U.S. military veterans attributed their diseases to what actually happened to them while they were in the Gulf War. What's your take on that? We have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, well, as usual, when the United States goes to war and soldiers are impacted in incredibly negative ways, Vietnam, Agent Orange is an example, the government tries to pretend like it didn't happen, try to save money, and, you know, the government lasts a long time, and we're going to die. So at some point, a lot of us die, and we can't hold the government accountable. Eventually, if you keep struggling with them, as they have with Gulf War Syndrome to some extent and with Agent Orange, they'll start to recognize it. But by that time, many people have died from the injuries. And where did it come from? Some of it certainly was depleted uranium. Some of it was the burn pits of the chemicals that were released because a lot of soldiers burned some of the chemical weapons that were found in Iraq. So there's different ways that people were impacted. That's one of the reasons they called it Gulf War Syndrome. I want to point out that until that invasion, we did not have real major forces in the region. That was a contested area during the Cold War. And so really that invasion, and as Jerry said, and I say all the time, was the first ground war of the current era that we're still in. So this war in Iraq's been going on for 26 plus years. And ever since then, we've had major forces in the region so that we can try to either continue to have chaos in the region, so no one has control of what's going on there, or we have control of what's going on there. So George Bush Sr. established I believe, the bedrock for the chaos and the dying that's taking place in the region right now.
No, I think those are really, that's a really, really important point. It was the it was a turning page. It was a fork in the road. It started a new era. And if we think back, now we have George H.W. Bush bombing Iraq, Bill Clinton bombing Iraq, George W. Bush bombing Iraq, Barack Obama bombing Iraq, and Donald Trump, the bombs are still falling in Iraq. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We were joined from Missouri by Michael McPherson. He's the executive director of Veterans for Peace, and he is a Gulf War veteran. We were also joined by Jerry Condon. Jerry is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister. He is currently the national president of Veterans for Peace. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Global carbon emissions rose by 2.7% this year, following a 1.6% increase last year. Scientists blame strong economies in India and China and say that those countries are burning more coal and the middle classes there are buying more and more cars. But per capita carbon emissions remain highest by far in Europe and the United States. They also say that we have passed a point of no return on carbon emissions and climate change. We're joined from New York by Scott Edwards, co-director of the Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on again.
Scott, when I was at the CIA, and this was a long time ago, this was in the 1990s, I was on the analytics side, and the Directorate of Intelligence, the directorate that handles analysis, decided to set up something called the National Environmental Center. This was at the urging of then-Vice President Al Gore, because the environment is a national security issue, right? And Gore was always concerned about climate change. Well, I remember one of the findings early on, and this National Environmental Center no longer exists. As you can imagine, it was immediately done away with by George W. Bush. But one of the early conclusions was that sometime in the next 30 years or so, the country of Bangladesh is going to essentially cease to exist because 75% of the country is 6 feet above sea level or less. And people can't go north into the mountains because there are tribes there that will kill them if they try to, as well as poisonous snakes and man-eating wolves. And just, it's like a horror show over there. In the meantime, Mauritius and the Maldives are both worried about just sinking below the sea. It's going to happen. And in the Maldives, people are already beginning to emigrate to Pakistan and to India. And here in the United States, we're talking realistically of Miami being underwater in the next 20 or 30 years, of lower Manhattan being underwater. We're talking about major life changes just because of climate change. Is there any good news here? Is there anything to look forward to and any real changes on the horizon?
I think that it is a dire picture that we're facing. And you know, to your point on national security, despite the current Trump administration's attempts to just scuttle any type of climate change discussion, purging it from websites, the Department of Defense still today recognizes national security as being significantly threatened from climate change. I mean, they point out that, you know, even internationally, most of our military, all of our military bases are in coastal regions that are now being threatened with flooding. And so it is a huge, major threat. And we've seen report after report, the IPCC report in October, then just much more recently, the fourth National Climate Assessment report, and now this new Carbon Project report. And so there's a lot of bad news. But yes, there are things that we can do, and it's going to take a monumental effort on our part to make sure it happens. We can turn this around if we start to push bad politicians out of office here in the United States, certainly, and replace them with progressive folks. And we're seeing a little bit of that happening and a climate discussion in this country that's reached heights that it's never reached before and is now a major topic of conversation. That doesn't address the international problem. And as you point out, this report points to China and India as being the largest, being responsible for the largest increases. But the United States is also, you know, the you said the national was 2.7. U.S. is at 2.5 increases this year too. So they're about on that scale.
Wow.
So and we are the largest carbon emitters in the world. So our 2.5 is very significant. So we need to turn this around. We can turn it around. There is hope that it can be done. There is still time to act.
What can we do, actually? I know we don't burn as much coal as we used to, but practically everybody in America owns a car. We don't spend enough money on public transport and infrastructure there. What can we do here in the United States?
You know, before you answer, Scott, I want to just throw in a concept. When the United States was at war with Japan and Germany, the Roosevelt administration brought together the Manhattan Project. All of the scientists, all of the engineers brought together for the purpose of making a nuclear bomb. And thus they did. So within a short amount of time, this new technology, pretty horrible technology, was created. But it was on the basis of a national emergency, a recognized emergency. And so the government could be the player to marshal all of these forces. Now, if we had a situation where this government and other governments declared both a national and an international emergency and brought every sort of asset to the table with the idea that we're going to stop emitting carbon, we're going to start to replace dirty oil and coal, other pollutants, and we're going to do it using wind and solar, et cetera. I actually believe this is very doable because the human race has done so much and is doing so much with technology. It's really a matter of will. And it's a matter of removing the institutional impediments to carrying out that focused reorganization of society and the way we both use energy and the way we consume.
No, absolutely right. And you know, there are studies, lots of studies out there from environmental engineers, energy experts that lay out roadmaps on how to get to 100% renewable, clean energy in the United States and elsewhere within the next couple of decades. And so it is, you're absolutely right. The big impediment we have is that when it comes to energy policy in this country and around the world, it is literally being scripted by the fossil fuel companies. ExxonMobil walks into the White House and literally scripts our energy policy. And no surprise, that means they're keeping us addicted to fossil fuels for decades and decades to come. Even if it means the complete destruction of this planet, they're just looking at short-term economic gain. And so that's what we need to get rid of, and that's why this is a political solution, not a technological solution. I mean, I'll be the first to admit there are some technological gaps in terms of storage and aviation and those kinds of things. But as you say, we can overcome this, right? It's just funny when I listen to conservatives talk about things like American exceptionalism. We can overcome any challenge, and we're so great. And Well, here's a challenge. Why don't we try overcoming this one, right? We did have a Marshall Plan. We did have a World War II mobilization at a time of crisis. This crisis is planet-threatening. If we can't match that effort, we're done for.
Yeah, that's the voice of Scott Edwards. Scott is the co-director of the Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. John, you know, we remember Nero as somebody who fiddled while Rome burned. But here you have Trump, the White House, and the people that they're serving, meaning ExxonMobil and the others, they're not just fiddling, they're bringing matches to the fire.
Yeah.
Or gasoline would be a better way to put it, or oil, to pour onto the fire because, you know, it is burning, the planet is burning, and it needs to stop burning.
Yeah, absolutely correct. And Scott is right. This isn't something new. This isn't new information. We've known for many years.
And Scott, ExxonMobil knew it.
Yeah, and ExxonMobil knew it and covered it up.
Exxon was the first to know it, perhaps.
You know, I was disappointed too, Scott, to see, what was it, a couple of months ago, T. Boone Pickens, who had plans for this massive wind farm or wind field in the Midwest, just walk away from it. He said he was willing to spend $1 billion of his own dollars to do this. And he said that there was just zero interest in this. And indeed, it was the oil companies that were fighting it, and he just walked away from it, which I think is another setback.
A huge setback. And so we have people in who are in a position to promote these things, being just giving up and walking away. And I can rest assured, you can be rest assured that they are making their money elsewhere and getting payoffs from oil and gas industry. And you know, you got the fracking industry that's holding itself out as our savior for climate. It is just as bad as other fossil fuels. No one's measuring methane emissions from fracking, and that's a huge greenhouse gas pollutant that's much more potent than CO2. So we just need to shift completely off fossil fuels, natural gas, coal, oil. We need to leave those things where they are in the ground and move on to wind and solar. And you've got Republican right-wing think tanks and lobbyists like ALEC out there working at the state level to undermine even people putting solar panels on their roofs. There are states across this country where ALEC and the right wing have successfully passed state legislation to financially punish people who put solar panels on their roof. I mean, it's insane.
That's just incredible to me.
You know, capitalism is always promoting the work ethic, but it's really just the profit ethic. And the ethic, or it's an oxymoron, but, you know, that's what it's all about. These old rich people or older rich people, they figure, hey, I'm not going to see the end of the species as we know it or organized human society. And my rich kids, they're going to be, well, rich enough that they're going to be able to handle it. I think it's like that. They know it's happening, but they don't give a damn because they prefer profit.
Yeah, there's a company called INEOS overseas. They are huge petrochemical plastics manufacturer. The plastics industry is built off fossil fuels, right? So it's another huge contributor to this whole fossil fuel addiction we have. And this guy Ratcliffe, one of the biggest, he's the CEO of INEOS and one of the wealthiest people on the planet. He has yachts. He races yachts. He holds himself as an environmentalist. He built his house on the coast of England on hydraulic stilts. A mansion that he can jack up as sea levels rise. I mean, this is
perfect,
right? So yeah, you're right. This is some of their mentality, but it's, you know, again, it's ignorance, it's short sightedness. Our food systems are crashing. Our water. I mean, you can jack your house up as high as you want. We are going to have a massive disaster, a crisis that raising your house a few feet on your hydraulics is simply not going to fix.
No. Well, that was the voice of Scott Edwards, who joined us from New York. Scott's co-director of the Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Two independent academics at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies will soon release a report in which they conclude that North Korea is expanding two missile bases that could be used to house long-range ballistic missiles. South Korean military officials said that they are monitoring the situation in cooperation with the United States, but there have been no formal announcements by any party. We're joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Simone, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Yes, nice to be back.
Simone, I first saw this story on CNN, and then I decided to look a little more deeply in the print media, and this is not what it's cracked up to be. There are a lot of what-ifs, and there's a lot of analysis that's not necessarily based on fact so much as it is based on speculation. What do you think about this story?
Yes, indeed. Yes. Also, I did watch CNN's reporting late last night, and it was all, you know, like almost like a pre-war situation.
Oh, breathless.
Yes, and you are right. There is really no substance, and this is appeared to be another sort of systematic attempt to sabotage the U.S.-North Korean negotiations. And before we go into the more details about the report, let's look at the timing. As you might recall, Kim Jong-un, might visit South Korea either in December this month or in January. And another thing that we have to pay attention to is the possible, obviously, upcoming second Trump-Kim summit. And so I think that what's happening right now is that we will also see more reporting like this, and that there is sort of a systematic attempt to destroy or sabotage the any negotiation progress in the U.S. and North Korea negotiations, which has been actually also part of a pattern in the history for the last two decades. And to go more in detail, we can talk more. There is actually a Korean progressive investigative reporter did the research and found out that there was a, you know, the picture that were taken was the one of the so-called new satellite picture was taken in 2014. How new is that? And and then if you look at it, and it's kind of picture is very blurry, and the upper right side corner is clearly stated April 16, 2004. And that is apparently what they called additional tunnel entrances. And then the investigative report also compared these pictures with the apparently what, you know, what they claim as new one that was taken August 2018, and I found that actually there aren't much significant differences, and so you can also see that, you know, how we can dispute the claim. And moreover, this called Yongjae-dong missile base, that was known since July 1999. So there is actually, there's nothing new there. And moreover, the most important claim, that is, they found that there is really no trace or evidence of, you know, possibility of North Korea's planning for the nuclear ICBM in any of those 11 pictures that the CNN claims. And lastly, the Korean reporter tried to contact the two so-called independent analyst, and ask them to clarify. And so far, they have not really heard any responses from them. So in a nutshell, I think this is, I would say this is another, you know, fake news, and try to sabotage the negotiation.
You know, we use the term fake news, or we hear it a lot, but this is fake news. And Professor Simone Chun is correct. You look at the headline, North Korea is expanding missile base with eye towards U.S. Sounds categorical, mm-hmm. right? Definitive, mm-hmm. comma, experts warn. Then, so the headline at the end says, oh, it's actually experts. Well, who are the experts? There's two of them. There's exactly two. One is Jeffrey Lewis and the other is David Schmierer of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey in California. And then this, after this categorical headline, and that these, you know, sort of grainy satellite images showing the expanded ICBM base, you actually get into the New York Times article because you got to get down to the sixth or seventh paragraph. And here's what it says. But their geographic locations, meaning the pictures, the locations of the things that we're looking at through the satellite imagery, their geographic locations make them ideal to house long-range missiles. So it makes them ideal. That doesn't mean that they're there. That just means they would be ideal, at least according to these two independent experts. And then listen to this. The base is located in the interior of North Korea, backed up against the Chinese border. That sounds scary. It is the location that leads us to believe that the general area is a strong candidate for the deployment of future missiles that can strike the United States.
How many qualifiers are in that sentence?
It leads us to believe it's a strong what? A candidate. For the deployment when? In the future. I mean, it's fake news.
You know, actually, I couldn't resist last night. I actually posted my response to actually Donald Trump's Twitter. And this is the first time I did it. And I told him, you know, there's looks like a fake news, and who tried to sabotage any progress, you know, you made. But I would actually, you know, quote Leon Siegel, who responded to previous New York Times fake news about this, you know, similar sort of using blurry satellite pictures, old pictures, claiming, making all this claim. And he said that substituting tendentious hyperbole for sound reporting may convince editors to feature a story on the page one, but it is disservice to readers. And I really agree with him. And this is, seems to be another case. Now this time it's led by the CNN. And it seems to me that their purpose is to have this headline, let's say new satellite images reveal activity at unidentified North Korean missile base. That was the set, New York Times. And then followed by today's, there was the CNN followed by today's New York Times. And the substance really doesn't matter. And they seem to be, it's like they think that maybe readers won't pay attention to all the details. And then just the only thing that the message they're going to have is this sort of a, you know, discredit North Korea. You know, North Korea can be trusted and et cetera. So I think that this is really disappointment. And most important thing that I think we have to pay attention to is all the progress that still is being made. As you recall, this last week, North and South Korea started the inter-Korean railway, new connection of inter-Korean railway, which is truly historic, and which was actually supported now by United States. And the poll shows that 6 out of 10 Koreans support, you know, Kim Jong-un's visit to South Korea. And today, we're going to announce that a strong Korean-American and American peace actually supporting this new statement, you know, from the civic organizations, basically demanding the peace treaty, also following the Singapore summit. 160 civic organizations in the United States have signed on to it. And also one more progress. There's right now South Korea is supporting and being more proactive in actually helping North Korea with regard to humanitarian issues. South Korean humanitarian civic organizations are making visits to North Korea. And I can just make, you know, we can list goes on. So this is time. Enormous progress is being made. But American corporate media doesn't want to report any of those. They have their own propaganda going on, and we should stop it.
Yeah, it is propaganda. Going on in the New York Times article, the New York Times then cites another think tank as if there's another important news here. And the think tank turns out to be the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, which, of course, works with the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex and doesn't want peace to break out in the Korean Peninsula. But it said in a report published last month, a Washington-based research institution, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said it had located more than a dozen North Korean missile bases still in operation. Well, guess what, everybody? North Korea did not promise to completely unilaterally disarm itself prior to the signing of an agreement with the United States. The first point of the Singapore summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump was calling for the improvement in relations between North Korea and the United States. It's only number 3 that you get down to the issue of denuclearization, again, not just for North Korea, but the entire Korean Peninsula. And nowhere does it say, now, guess what? North Korea must get rid of all weapons, get rid of all defensive capability, announce its own surrender in order for talks to continue. That's not what this is going. So for the CSIS to locate more bases, and again, who knows? It sounds like something. It's nothing. Simone Chun, 30 seconds left. In spite of the New York Times, in spite of the mainstream media, CNN, opposing this thing, it seems to me what you're saying is that the Korean people want this to go forward.
Yes, there's still very strong support, and the President Moon Jae-in and has very, strong support, not only from within Korea, but also Korean Americans and the peace activists and also world leaders. And one more point that we wanted to point out is that going back to your CSIS, and this is about the military industrialization think tank, and their attempt to sabotage campaign will not succeed. And that has been the history, but I think that we will eventually prevail. I think history is on our side, and that we should give all the support we can to Koreans who are trying to make historic progress.
We will leave it there. That was the voice of Professor Simone Chun, who joined us from Seattle. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.